Welcome to Case in Point. My name is Claire Finkelstein, and I am the Algernon Biddle Professor of Law and Professor of Philosophy. I am also the Faculty Director of the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law here at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School. With me today is Director James Clapper, a retired Lieutenant General in the United States Air Force and the former Director of the Office of the Directorate of National Intelligence. Director Clapper joins us to discuss his book, Facts and Fears, Hard Truths from a Life in Intelligence. Thank you so much, Director Clapper, for joining us.
Thanks, Claire, for having me.
This is an extraordinary book, the tale of such a long span in the intelligence community and how you came to that experience. But the thing that's really most remarkable about this book is the light that you shed on our intelligence challenges and our national security challenges after 9/11. Can you describe a little bit what really changed in U.S. national intelligence after 9/11?
Well, obviously 9/11 was a national trauma for all of us, and it similarly was a trauma for the intelligence community. There, not surprisingly, there was an investigation of what happened and why the attack was allowed to happen in the manner in which it did. A Blue Ribbon Commission was put together, which made some recommendations which found their way into what's called the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act, which President Bush signed into law on the 17th of December, 2004. And among other things, it established the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. And so for the first time in the history of the U.S. intelligence community, certainly going back to 1947, the intelligence community, as large an enterprise as it is, had a director whose full-time duty was to promote integration, collaboration, and coordination across the entirety of the intelligence community. Other things that happened was the establishment of the Department of Homeland Security, some surveillance authorities that the Congress gave to the intelligence and law enforcement community, the inclusion of the FBI as part of the intelligence community. So there are really a series of profound changes that occurred in the wake of 9/11.
Do you feel that the blame that was cast on the intelligence community in the run-up to 9/11 and the lack of coordination between the CIA and the FBI did play a big role in making us vulnerable to the 9/11 attacks?
Well, I'm not sure about that. I mean, we had 9/11, so let's reorganize. To this day, I'm not sure that, what was done, the prescription that was handed to the intelligence community was actually the cure. Now, knock on wood, we haven't had a major attack of the ilk of the 9/11 attacks since then. And so we'll never really know. I think the intelligence community is better and stronger for having had the passage of the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act, because from the simple fact that the sum is always greater than the parts, and that's certainly the case here. I will say, though, that there needs to be a full-time champion and advocate for coordination and integration across the intelligence community, because that's not something that it's a natural act for the intelligence community or, for that matter, any bureaucracy.
Despite the greater strength of the intelligence community, there have been increasing attacks on the intelligence community with the current administration. What do you think is the source of those attacks, and what can be done to restore the faith in the intelligence community for this administration?
Well, I'm not sure that's possible. I think President Trump had a latent suspicion of the intelligence community. It was part of the so-called deep state, which I'd never heard of before. And I think the finding of the intelligence community assessment in January of 2017 that the Russians interfered in the election and were opposed to and tried to do all they could to hurt the candidacy of Hillary Clinton and to help the candidacy of Donald Trump. And so I think the finding that the conclusion that we came to in his mind cast doubt on the legitimacy of his election. So he's from the start, from the get-go, was a skeptic about the intelligence community. Then he accused the intelligence community of leaking the infamous dossier and called the I was still the DNI at the time, called us Nazis publicly. And so relationship sort of got off to a bad start, and it hasn't improved since.
When did you first learn about the Russian interference with the 2016 election, and what was your reaction when you heard it?
FAQ, frequently asked question. What is the exact moment in time when you realized the Russians were interfering? Well, the Russians have always interfered in our elections, and in fact, interfered in their elections and other people's. And we have records going back at least to the 60s where the Russians in some way, ham-handed normally and pretty obvious, attempted to influence the outcome of elections. The difference, though, in 2016, we've never seen the magnitude, scope, depth, and aggressiveness of their campaign to influence the election as was exhibited in 2016. That was the difference. There wasn't an individual specific moment of revelation. It occurred over time, particularly during the spring, into the summer, and of course, fall of 2016. And it was, you know, all revelation doesn't occur in one day. So it was through that time period when more and more we understood the magnitude of what they were doing.
There have been doubts cast on the proposition that it was the Russians that hacked the DNC and that the information that went to WikiLeaks came from the Russians. Can you comment on those attacks on that hypothesis?
I will just say that the evidence we had, that's why we had such a high confidence in it. The evidence, notably the forensic evidence, was overwhelming. It was the Russians. It was not the Chinese. It was not the Ukrainians. It was not the 400-pound guy in his bed in New Jersey. It was the Russians. And there was absolutely no doubt in my mind. Our findings were very solid in 2017, and I stand on them today.
The Russians were very, very active on social media, they had an enormous presence on Facebook, Instagram, just about every corner of social media. And one of the things that they are accused of doing is to put out a lot of negative propaganda on Hillary Clinton. Your book describes the Russian efforts to cast doubt on her probity, to raise concerns about her private server and so on. Can you talk a little bit about the effect that you think that had and whether it might have had any impact on the election?
Well, I think it had a huge impact. In fact, it's my belief that actually had more impact on the election than did the actions that Jim Comey took. Because the Russian effort was over a period of time was pervasive. Huge magnitude. The Russians reached 132 million Americans on Facebook alone. And they had messages for everybody, for Black Lives Matter, for white supremacists, for pro-Nazis, anti-Nazis, pro-gun control, anti-gun control. It didn't matter. The Russians are very sophisticated at exploiting the polarization and divisiveness in this country. I believe they helped to depress the vote in certain areas, notably the three states that were key, where the president-elect at the time won by less than 80,000 votes. So to me, it stretches credulity to think that the Russians had no impact on the election. I think they had a huge impact. That is not, I hasten to emphasize, not an indictment of anybody who voted for President Trump. It is an indictment of the Russians and our permissiveness, frankly, in allowing them to do what they did without sounding a louder clarion call to the American people.
What could President Obama have done that he didn't do when he first learned about the Russian attacks on our election?
Well, first, why didn't he take more aggressive action is another frequently asked question. Well, a couple reasons. One, we were very concerned, and we had many meetings, lots of discussion about this, and discussed many options that we could have invoked. But I think there was concern first about, by doing so, making a big thing of what the Russians were doing, that we would only serve to amplify it, to dignify it, if you will, give it more stature than we wanted. I think the other major reason, though, was the president was very reticent about the appearance of putting his hand on the scale in favor of one candidate and to the disfavor of the other candidate against the backdrop of the allegation by then candidate Trump that if he didn't win the election, it was rigged. And so the president was very reluctant, President Obama at the time, very reluctant to feed that narrative. So I wish we had department, I guess, is the measures that we didn't take until the 29th of December. I wish we'd done before the election. I wish we'd been more public and vociferous about what the Russians were doing. We had a lot of discussion about this and was finally agreed that Jay Johnson and I, who was then Homeland Security Secretary, would put out a joint statement, which we did on the 7th of October of 2016, a month before the election. Unfortunately, our message, our statement was emasculated by the revelation of the Access Hollywood tapes, which came out that same day, as well as the revelation about the Podesta hack of his emails. So our important message, which was pretty candid and forthright, kind of got lost. So I wish we'd done more in the way of punishment beyond PNGing, you know, kicking out 35 Russian operatives and closing two of Dachas, one of which on the eastern shore of Maryland was a big intelligence collection site for the Russians. And we imposed sanctions on some individual Russians. But that wasn't done until the 29th of December.
Is there any kind of military action, for example, using cyber, that we might have used if we had wanted to take steps beyond sanctions and diplomatic efforts?
All kinds of options that we could have and discussed. But the problem there, as it always is with cyber, is if you're going to engage in a cyber attack, you want to be sure that you have thought about what the counter retaliation might be and whether or not you have the resilience to recover. Because while the U.S. approach has traditionally been very precise, surgical, and legalistic, you can't count on an adversary, whether it's Russia, North Korea, Iran, to be similarly precise, surgical, and legalistic. So it's ostensibly, superficially appealing to do cyber things, but you want to be sure you've thought through what the implications are of a counter-retaliation and whether you can withstand it or not.
Just a last question, Director Clapper, which is there have been a lot of claims on the part of the Trump administration that the Trump campaign was spied on. There's a lot of anger around a supposed deep state conspiracy, and a lot of that has focused on the FISA warrant of Carter Page. Can you explain a little bit to the public what that surveillance was all about, and whether or not the Trump campaign was indeed spied on?
Well, that's a phraseology I would take issue with. I don't think that's a fair characterization. We were accused of surveilling Trump Tower and a lot of other wild things that we weren't. I will tell you, I was concerned, as were others in the administration, about all these meetings that members of the Trump camp were having with the Russians, of all people. Why the Russians? Why so many meetings? And we didn't know what was going on in these meetings necessarily. We didn't have access to the substance of them, but there was concern about that, particularly with respect to sort of violation of the historical norm of there being only one president and one administration in charge at a time. And so there was a lot of concern about this. My practice as DNI, since the DNI has no role in FISA authorization requests, I left it entirely up to the two directors of the FBI that I work with, Bob Mueller and then Jim Comey, to decide whether, when, and what to tell me about any counterintelligence investigation because of the extreme sensitivity and the potential for involvement of U.S. persons. I really didn't want to know about them unless they, in their judgment, I needed to be. So I didn't know about the investigation nor the FISA warrant against Carter Page, who, by the way, had been on the FBI's radar scope since about 2013. So the FISA authorization request that is so controversial and was a subject of the DOJ, Department of Justice Inspector General report, was actually the fourth extension and was actually done after Carter Page left his or ended his affiliation with the Trump campaign. So it's regrettable that some errors of omission and commission were made with that authorization request. I know that Director Wray has gone to school on fixing those, addressing those issues and coming up with ways to avoid a recurrence. But I think the whole business about spying on the Trump campaign is from my vantage at least, overblown.
And finally, how can you reflect on the dangers that the attacks on the intelligence community really pose for our national security? If we can't find a way to restore the faith in the intelligence community on the part of the administration, or have a new administration that is inclined to trust the deliverances of intelligence experts, what kind of position does that put us in our national security?
There's a fundamental tenet for intelligence professionals and it's a bit of a simplistic bumper sticker, but it captures the thought, which is truth to power. And the importance for intelligence people of always rendering what the facts are as best intelligence facts are as best the intelligence community can come up with them. And if there is a refusal to listen to that or pay attention to it, which is, by the way, is a policymaker's option. Any policymaker can accept, reject, or ignore the intelligence that he or she's given. That is strictly their prerogative, to include policymaker number one. I would offer, though, that doing so over a long period of time for multiple issues puts the country in jeopardy, because if the policymaker's worldview and the intelligence community's assessment is widely different, that is not good for national security, because then you have people living in an unreality bubble, which could be quite dangerous for the country.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us today, Director Clapper.